I do my show on the Heritage Radio Network because I think it's important to talk about the impact of technology on our lives.
I do my show to reach home cooks and help them do better.
I love getting together with people in the industry.
I like hosting my show because, to me, it's the stories about people and their relationship to food that help make the food more interesting and more delicious.
Our hosts do their shows as a labor of love, but we still need your financial support in order to keep the lights on and keep the tape rolling. Please become a member today at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43 and the Good Beer Seal. Today is Tuesday, June 28th, 2016. We've got some great guests joining us tonight to discuss beer trademarks, including our friend Brendan Palfreyman from Syracuse
Esquire
and Jordan Greenberger Esquire from right here in Brooklyn. I think we're going to call this show The Beer Lawyers because we're going to talk about beer trademarks, and later Doug Reese from Burial Beer and Riser Legal will be calling in. He's got his own beer company and his own legal company, so that's going to be interesting calling, right?
Yeah, it'd be interesting to watch him go to trial, too. Yeah. Like, that's a fun way to jazz up the courtroom.
And of course, Ambassador's in the house. All right.
Hello.
So, you know, our Beer Sessions Radio is brought to you by Union Beer Distributors, supplier of world-class ales and lagers. So guys, you know, Brendan, you've been on before, and for years we've talked about beer trademarks, and you know, I know you're a real big, you know, beer enthusiast, a home brewer, and Jordan says he likes beer too. So give us a little, like, you know, tutorial on trademarks for beer. Like, why do we need them? Why is there history of trademarks at all? And, you know, little overview to start the conversation.
Sure, Jimmy. Yeah, thanks for having me again. Trademarks, well, the first thing that sort of needs cleaning up a little bit is that there's more or less three different types of intellectual property: copyrights, trademarks, and patents, and they get thrown around, you know, for the same things when really they're very, very different. So a trademark is something that is used to identify the source of a product. So a name, a logo, even a color. And the history of trademarks and beer trademarks, as we'll get into, is fascinating. And in fact, the first, if you go onto the UK trademark website, the first trademark ever registered, literally number 00000001, is the Bass Triangle. And that's the first registered trademark in the history of the world. So people have been doing this for a while.
I feel smart for knowing that.
No, that's cool. That's good. And for you, Jordan, you know, what's your backstory on trademarks and patents?
Sure. So Brendan's absolutely right. There's three types of intellectual property generally, and trademarks identify sources of good. I'll add, you can also trademark a sound in addition to color and name and logo. So, you know, with beers, you can think of, if you're in a bar, you hear the name of the brand of a beer or the brewery or the type of beer. You could also see it on a case, on a shelf, you would recognize the name or the logo. Now, logos also, and the labeling can also have elements of copyright protection on them. If there is unique artwork, drawings, design, which is separate, right? So that's the creative authorship of, it's a creative work of authorship, the painting, the picture, that's subject to copyright protection. But the branding, the name of the brewery, the type of beer, that's more of what we think of when we think of trademark.
Yes. So, for example, the name of the show is Beer Sessions. That's a trademark. The content of the show...
You may have worked on that for me, too.
The content of the show, the actual, what you're listening to right now, is copyrightable. This is
it's a sound recording.
Yeah, a work of original authorship.
Yeah. Hmm. And then what is, let's say I'm a new brewery, and I know, are you at liberty to say any breweries that you've worked with?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what can a lawyer say and not say. I don't know.
I guess just ask until he says no. Why not?
Yeah, I work with around 40, 45 breweries, primarily in New York, but also in the Northeast. I do work for Empire, Ithaca, do some work for them. Oh, sorry. Bunch of breweries in Rochester and Buffalo, Albany. I do work for Rare Form up in Troy, which is a great little brewery.
Can I ask you, at what point do they contact you? I mean, is it every stage from we're going to name our brewery, we're getting our logo set, or is it just like we have a new beer, we want to get a label on? Like, at what point is it all or nothing? Are you someone that you hire for every little thing, or can you just go, I have one new beer, I need a lawyer for it, can you look it over?
It's best for people to get their trademark attorneys involved as soon as possible, mm-hmm. and really to have multiple names in mind, because people will fall in love with one name, and then a 5-second search on the government website breaks a lot of hearts.
Yeah, or they don't do it at all, and they take it to the next level without having done that.
But yeah, typically what happens is someone will call me up and say, "I have oftentimes they've either just received a cease and desist letter, or they thought of a cool new name and they want to protect it." At which point, typically a trademark search will be run to see if it's feasible to get that name, and you'll think about whether the name itself is trademarkable, because, as Jimmy knows, certain things can't be trademarked.
Can I just interject for a second on the trademark search, too? Anne was saying you can Google it. You can go on the trademark office's website. Well, you can also pay services, and that's where a lot of people don't want to do is pay the money for the service, but they run these really comprehensive searches of not only national databases, international databases. They'll do just extremely comprehensive searches, and that's, I would say, recommended. You ask Brendan, when are people calling you? In my experience, whether it's trademark related or really any legal issue, it's not too late, but it's later than they should have. When they're confronting an issue that if they would have talked to a lawyer or just thought about it or asked other people in the industry beforehand, how do I proceed? That you can avoid a lot of headache and cost, investing money in a brand, not only your emotional investment in the name of a brewery or a type of beer, but if you're starting to print labels, cans, marketing materials, work on your website, why go through that if only to find out in a few months that, hey, there's somebody else out there with senior rights?
So you have to spend the money for a lawyer anyways.
You can either spend a little in the beginning or a lot at the end.
Right,
that's what
prevention.
You're saying. Yeah, exactly. Can I ask you guys, so you're a new brewery or a brewery in general, and you have a new idea for a beer. Can you kind of walk through the steps and the process of like getting the name protected, getting the label artwork protected, getting it okayed by the, by the whatever.
Exactly, the whatever.
So. The whatever. No,
TTV.
The,
let's start with Brendan.
Thank you, TTV. Hello.
So let's say I'm Little Jimmy's Brewery. First, is that
what
name,
do you brew?
I don't know. I'm not even a brewer. He's the brewer. But Little Jimmy's Brewery, is that name even trademarkable?
Yes,
it is.
Yeah. Whereas if you tried to trademark Carboni Brewery, you probably couldn't do that. At least not for a certain amount of time, because you can't. Generally, you can't get a federal trademark, with exceptions, obviously. But on things that are geographically descriptive, so like New York City Brewing Company, things that are primarily merely a surname, so Carboni Brewing Company, and things that are just descriptive, so cold beer or hoppy beer. Or
what about, like, so Anne has kind of a nickname, Anne Likes Beer. Could it be Anne Likes Beer Brewery?
Sure. Yeah.
That's a great idea. No,
it's kind of, it's interesting because there's all these exceptions, and I don't know.
Well, you could also, if there's a Little Johnny's Brewery out there, they might oppose any effort for you to go forward with Little Jimmy's, right? So in theory, yes, Little Jimmy's is trademark. You could have rights in that. But if there's somebody else in the marketplace, really trademark, especially when it comes to litigation or cease and desist letters, the question is there a likelihood of consumer confusion? That's the test nationwide. So once somebody establishes that they own a trademark, the next step that a court of law will look at is there a likelihood of consumer confusion? And throughout the country, there's different tests. Here in New York, it's called the Polaroid test. In the federal circuit, it's DuPont, I think. And there's all these factors that they'll go through. So just because Little Jimmy's might be original or subject to stronger trademark protection.
Not that original.
Well, right, exactly. It's not. So that would be considered, as well as if there's anybody else in the marketplace that has a confusingly similar name.
Is that why, like, some companies, like a phone company, would make up a brand like Verizon? So it's like a totally made up brand. Is that more trademarkable than?
Right. So there's different levels on the spectrum, ranging from generic, which you cannot have any trademark protection in, to arbitrary or fanciful. So arbitrary refers to marks that are used on a good. It could be beer. It could be really anything, a cell phone service that doesn't relate in any way to the product or describe its services. Fanciful is just a made-up word, right? So Verizon, I don't know what that means. I would imagine that is a made-up word meant to distinguish their goods. So that is subject to the highest levels of
trademark. It means expensive in Dutch.
And on my phone bill. Yeah.
Okay, but so I figure, like, a show like this would really appeal. I mean, there's so many breweries opening up, a new one every hour or something insane. So I kind of feel like this is who that would reach out to, people opening new breweries, starting new companies. And if someone were to do that, what are the actual steps? Okay, first, you know, from beginning to end, just say, let's say you're starting a new nano brewery. Where do you begin as far as trademarking your name, website, that kind of thing?
When I get that type of call from a brewery in planning, the first things I recommend are, you know, do at least a quick Google search on your own and start locking down the Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all the social media platforms. And then on the trademark side, you file what's called an intent to use application, which you can file up to 3 years in advance of actually beginning selling beer. So it's a way that the government allows you to lock a name down early in the process, so you don't, because otherwise you'd have to wait till you actually had trademark use, which is beer sales, to get the application going.
On the intent to use application, you have to have a bona fide intent to actually use the mark.
That was what I was just about to ask.
Right, bona fide is kind of one of these funny legal terms, but you really actually have to be starting the process of working on it.
You can't just lock down names.
What if someone registers a website and they don't really want to use it? What if a big brewery goes ahead and starts, you know, registering all these names that they might use down the road? Because I've seen that happen.
I think for websites, you're kind of opening a different can of worms, too, because there is this notion of cyber squatting and just going out there and grabbing domain names, you know, littlejimmies.com.
That's mine.
I don't want to go on littlejimmies.com. Yeah. I don't think anybody does. Next.
But it is related to trademarks, so there are ways that you can go about having the people, the WIPO, the people who really are responsible for domain names, to have somebody who is squatting on a domain name. A lot of people will just pick a domain name, sit on it, and then say, hey, I'll give it to you for $10,000. Whatever, they just make up a number because they're trying to hijack the name in exchange for a number. So you can do a proceeding where you do try to have the domain name transfer.
But in terms of trade, have some big breweries gone ahead and registered, you know, certain names, you know, like the and what is a name? Because it's like an IPA that's not trademarkable. But like, if I make up a name, like, you know, gigantic something, mm-hmm. I mean, if I go ahead and trademark that, you know, just tell me that.
You have to have an intent to use. Right?
I have an example. I'm going to tell it. This is my example. This is where we're at. A few years ago, our friends in New York, Barrier Brewing, had a label that came out, and this is something we can all talk about, called Ruthless Rye. And they got a letter from Sierra Nevada that said, oh, we've trademarked Ruthless. But even though they weren't using it as a rye, they had trademarked it. I don't know if they ever made it.
It's Sierra Ruthless Rye.
No, but then they were making it. But at the time when Barrier first came out with it about 5 years ago, Sierra had trademarked it but didn't have a Ruthless Rye. And I remember, if you know the case, that was very interesting. It wasn't even a case. It was a friendly letter. Mm-hmm. And Barry backed off, and now they call their rye the Evil Giant IPA. I don't know if that's a talking point.
I would guess that the trademark and Ruthless, if it was Ruthless Rye, disclaimed the rye part, because rye describes a type of beer or a ingredient in the beer. So the Ruthless part, you were asking before about levels of protection and Verizon being at one end and versus a generic. Ruthless, what does that have to do with beer? It's not a made-up word, but it's not suggestive of the type of beer, so it's fanciful. Somebody just assigned the name Ruthless to it. But, yeah, I mean, there are cases where there are disputes. People say, well, I make an ale and you make a lager. Well, okay, they're beer. I mean, beer's beer. And, you know, I think we'll get to that a little bit later, but...
Another question I get just along those exact lines is, I named my beer this. Somebody had a trademark for the brewery, but I can do it for a beer, right? Because that's a brewery and this is a beer. And the answer is no. They're way too close. So, for example, I couldn't go out and start, you know, Flower Power Brewing Company tomorrow because Ithaca has a registered trademark for Flower Power for beer.
Then you wrote about a similar case. Was it Black Ops?
Right. So there was a case in January of this past year where the Brooklyn Brewery here in New York brought a lawsuit in California against a small startup brewery that was called Black's Op Brewing or Black Ops Brewery. I don't recall which one. But Brooklyn Brewery has a seasonal release that they've had since, I think, 2007. It's a Russian Imperial Stout. And it's
may or may not exist.
Well, according to the record...
Beer joke.
According to the record, it exists, and it's on sale east of the Mississippi, and Brooklyn Brewery had intent to distribute it in California. And so this little startup brewery last year tries to get off the ground. They're only distributed in one county in California, three restaurants, two bottle shops. But the Brooklyn Brewery went after them. And I don't say that in a negative way. I mean, they have a federally registered trademark in the name Brooklyn Black Ops. And they ended up getting an injunction.
Someone's calling us right now about that.
That beer does not exist.
I tell you what, we're going to take a short break. This is a good starting point. We'll be back in a few minutes talking more about beer trademarks, beer lawyers on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Thank you.
In 1996, L. Knife & Son acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn, but has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Union Beer has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Kings County, Brooklyn, through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education on all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the 14 counties of southeastern New York. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, it's beer lawyers, beer trademarks, and we're getting crazy here. We're talking about Black Ops the beer versus Black Ops the brewery. Wow, man. That's crazy, Jordan.
Just settle down, everybody.
Yeah. Crazy, guys. Crazy. So, yeah, thanks. So the Brooklyn Brewery ended up getting an injunction, which is, in layman's terms, a court order telling that this California brewer that they couldn't use the name, they couldn't use the website that they had registered. And ultimately, if you look at the record, about two or three weeks later, the case settled, which probably should have happened beforehand. You know, it's always unfortunate when any case goes into litigation. And I think everybody here, we were talking before the show, there's a lot of letters, friendly or not, that go around when these types of issues come up, that hopefully you can avoid having to pay a lawyer and be involved in a lawsuit. But I mentioned before that there's a test that the courts apply in determining whether or not there's a likelihood of consumer confusion. And there was one part, I'm geeking out right now because I have a copy of the decision.
That's why you're on.
But
I feel so fancy.
One of the elements that a court looks at generally is the degree of care likely to be exercised by the purchaser. So is somebody who's purchasing a $1,000 product more likely to pay attention to the source of good than a $1 product, okay? So here, the beer, the Brooklyn Brewery's beer was $30 a bottle, and the California Brewer's was $5 a bottle. And the court kind of said, hey, beer's beer. You buy it in a chaotic environment like a bar, or maybe you're at a, you buy beer regularly. It's not some one-off purchase. And I ask you guys, you know, is that fair to the craft beer industry, to people who are really interested in microbreweries, craft breweries? You know, how much are people paying attention? Would you know the difference between a $30 Imperial Russian Stout and a $5 ale? It's a question I would ask you, but, you know, the court did say essentially beer is beer.
Well, I have to, on that note, excuse me, you know, obviously we are in a very beer-centric environment,
sure,
and we work in those environments as well. But, you know, for everybody that really knows every little detail about Brooklyn Black Ops, there's someone that just kind of sees it on a beer writing website, or, and I'm just playing devil's advocate, I have an aunt that calls me from the supermarket and goes, here's my choices, what should I get? And, you know, someone like her who is excited about it but doesn't really, I mean, she grabs it for fun. You know, I can completely understand how that would make a difference.
I don't think you're necessarily playing the devil's advocate, because it's the reasonable purchaser, and who's purchasing
beer?
Right. But you know, is it from the standard of a beer geek, or is it from the standard of your aunt in a supermarket?
Right, and the mass, you know, the majority of people who are actually buying these beers, I think.
And what about for you, Brendan?
Yeah, I mean,
I've
actually tried to make that argument in proceedings before the United States Patent Trademark Office, where one of my trademarks for a craft brewery was rejected based on a huge macro brewer's trademark. And I said, I don't know if the argument was, if it carried any weight at the USPTO or not, the trademark office, but I said, the craft beer consumer, like the consumer of this microbrewery's product, is very in tune to what they're purchasing and knows that it's not a macro lager.
Hold on 1 second. So I had a Hill Farms said Edward Pale Ale to start my night. It's something that's always on tap here at Roberta's in Bushwick. And Jordan, what did you bring? You brought like a real
Goza. I brought a Orange Blossom Goza from Platform Beer Company in Cleveland, Ohio. I had it a couple weeks ago when I was visiting family over Father's Day and
watching basketball.
I was watching basketball. Go Cavs. So the label says tart, salty, and aromatic, and I agree. I think it's a great summer session ale. It's about 4% ABV, and it's delicious. So if you're in Cleveland, check one out.
Can I ask you a trademark question about this beer? Because it's actually something I noticed right away. I've never heard of this brewery. And I looked it up, and on the side, it says, brewed and packaged by the Gypsy Brewery, Cleveland, Ohio. Okay, so it's Platform Beer Company, brewed and packaged by the Gypsy Brewery. That's a term we see all the time, and it's sort of a romanticized way of kind of, you know, talking about contract brewing or however you want to put it. Would they be able to trademark something like this? Because to the outside, you know, to maybe a court, they would say, all right, no one's used that. But it's a term we use all the time, even though no one's probably trademarked it yet. How do you deal with something like that? If it's just a common...
The Gypsy
Beer
Company.
Like a common phrase, right, but just something that people all say, but it might not necessarily be something that people would put on a label.
That's a good question.
So I would say one thing, you know, is there any other registered Gypsy Beer Company or Gypsy Brewery out there? But the second thing is, when you say the term Gypsy, what do you mean? Are you describing?
Contract.
Well,
like
they're going from place to place, right? So is it descriptive of the services that they're providing or the goods they're providing? Brendan, what do you think?
I think if you tried to file a trademark for Gypsy Brewer, you'd get a rejection from the trademark office saying, and even if they don't necessarily know what, like, you're probably not getting a beer nerd at the office there.
Right, that's
but
the point.
But they might slip it through.
They'll ask, like, is this a term of art in the industry? Does this have any descriptive meaning, to which you'd have to say, yeah, it does.
Yes, okay, that
in
was
which
the
case
question.
It'd be
hey, we've got a special call-in to Doug Reeser from Burial Beer Company, who's also an attorney. So he's like, Burial Beer, and he's Attorney Reeser Legal. How are you, Doug?
Hey, I'm doing pretty well. Can you guys hear me okay?
Good, man. I know. Did you follow what we were talking about?
I did. Where'd you find all these lawyers?
At the Homebrew Club.
Well, they're knocking down our doors. They take out ads in the subways in New York City. I don't know if you knew that.
Everybody sounds so smart in the room. I don't know that I'll have anything to add.
Well, did you ever register a trademark for your beers or anything?
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that? Sorry about that.
Have you ever registered a trademark for any of your beers?
Oh, every time. I think we have probably 60 to 70 trademarks for all of our beers at Burial Beer Company. And it's quite the task to try to manage them all.
What are some of the most unusual or outlandish names that you guys have trademarked?
Some of the ones that we have?
Yeah.
You know, it's as most people can attest to at this point, you know, the days of being able to acquire a single word trademark are almost over. It's very seldom that we're able to pull a mark on a scythe or a skillet or a surf wax like we used to be able to. Most of the ones we file now are the Triumph of Death or the Massacre of the Innocents or the Ascent of the Blessed.
Sounds like a Slayer song.
This actually circles back to something we were talking about, too, with the intent to use application, because you have an established brewery and you're coming out with new beers on a seasonal or whatever basis, but you can, you know, it's not just when a brewery is starting. This is also important for established breweries and established brands that are expanding their product lines, because every time you come out with a new beer, you know, you're investing time and money into that brand and what does it mean to the consumer. So you can already have a beer that you're brewing and realize that you haven't registered the trademark. It doesn't have to be at the earliest stages. Of course, that would be advisable, but existing breweries, do it with new beers you're producing. If you haven't registered it, you can go back and do it.
Doug, when you said managing that many, you said it's tasking. Once you get the trademark, what does the management like entail?
Well, it's really an in-depth process, and I would say, you know, basically to your last point, you know, a beer brand is conceived basically either as a really cool name or a really great formula, and it can start on either side of that, and you work towards the other. I would say that the vast majority of our marks start as a formula, and then we try to find a name, and so your beer protection process starts from the moment you have an idea to make a beer. And then, you know, once you have a formula, we have an idea of what the hell we want to do. We're on the internet, running test searches through the trademark database. We are looking through Untappd, through Rate Beer, through the colas that have been approved by the federal government to ensure that there are no confusing uses out there. And the process is, it takes weeks sometimes. And we just put out a hoppy Kolsch a couple, maybe a month ago, that it took us 2 weeks to come up with a name. Because everything we liked was taken or was confusing, or there was a wine or a whiskey or an energy drink. And it became such a daunting process to come up with something that you end up just throwing a dart at a dartboard. You end up compromising and being, you know, somewhat unhappy with the name you select when you start with the formula and then go look for a name. Seems like the only time you're happy is when you're starting with a name and then building a formula. But the process, beyond researching, I mean, that just gets you to a name. Then you've got to file your intent to use the mark. You got to plaster it out on the web, make sure that everybody knows that it's there. We're filing for colas with the federal government, with the state of North Carolina, and any other states we distribute in. As soon as we have a label or as soon as we have a keg collar for the beer. And then we got to go through the USPTO process, which, you know, it's a lengthy one. You're trying to track your marks. You're making sure they've been published. You're filing your extensions when you need to if you're not ready to show use in the marketplace, and you're filing your statements of use when you do have it. But it's a 15 to 18-month process sometimes just to get a mark registered. Can take longer if you're not using the mark across state lines. And that's just to get your mark. It's a whole other story to enforce your mark, because you're consistently... I wake up every morning and police on tap to find out if there's any other skillet stouts out there, or skillet anything, basically, which is kind of our most prized mark. And then I have to write the really awkward, terrible emails to the other brewers in a somewhat friendly way of telling them to change their brand.
Doug, sorry, what's the name of your new Hoppy Kolsch? Did you hear me?
What did you say?
What's the name of your new Hoppy Kolsch?
It's called Billows, as in smoke billows.
It's a
smoke signal from the mountaintop, the beer you drink when you reach the apex kind of type of thing.
I like it.
Let's ask everybody in the room, because we have a couple lawyers. So you guys, at some point, do you think that we should just stop naming our beers and just call them, you know, like regular brewery IPA? I mean, or is it making more work for you guys?
You got to do your homework. You know, you got to take the time. It's frustrating. I think that the beer names tell a story. Our beer names are very in-depth. Almost always, they tell a story of either the something from our own personal lives, from the story of burial, from the something that's inspiring or amused to us, or the beer itself and the process of making it. I think beer names are incredibly valuable. There are reasons you can sell a beer beyond how good it tastes in the package. A lot of people sell beer based upon names alone, or packaging alone,
The
uniqueness of the ingredients that are stated on the label. So I think they're there to stay, and it's really up to us as in the legal community, I think, to try to carve out some more narrow distinctions of what are per se confusing marks, because you know, the market is filled with wine and liquor and spirits and beer and energy drinks and soft drinks now, and sometimes bar services, and it's too much. And I think that it's going to be up to some really, really great lawyer somewhere to prove to the USPTO that you know, wine and beer can be considered different products, or spirits and beer can be considered different products, and give us the ability to acquire so many more names that are taken by all this type of label.
Yeah, I totally agree. That I have that fight with the USPTO every single, oh, not every day, but at least once a week, where a trademark for beer gets rejected based on a trademark for wine. So that's another thing that brewers have to keep in mind when they're clearing these names, is that if someone has a trademark for another alcoholic beverage, or in some cases even restaurant or bar services, that can block your trademark for beer.
I just want to go back to Jimmy's question that he asked about, should we even be having trademarks for things? So, you know, what Doug's talking about is how important it is for the brewery itself, for the brand. But the flip side is trademark actually protects the public, right? There's a huge public interest in enforceable trademarks, because consumers, whether it's beer, whether it's medicine, whether it's food, whatever, they want to know where their stuff's coming from and know that it's consistent. You know, if you think about McDonald's, every time you go to McDonald's, you know what that cheeseburger is going to taste like. And so there is this public interest. It's not just the brewery's perspective on why trademark's important in growing the brand and the goodwill, but the consuming public has a big interest in knowing the source of goods.
That's great, man. Great sum it up. Doug, stay on the line with us. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
She's her own. She's her own female. She's her own female. That's why I like her. I like her a lot. And she don't know that she's her own female. She's her own female. And she don't know. That's why I like her a lot. Caught a cab to the cafe to play the charming young man.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, we're talking beer trademarks, beer lawyers, and we got Doug from Burial down there. Hey, Doug, you still on, bro?
I'm here.
Okay, so we're gonna go. Jordan brought in an article about 1935, like a beer publication.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring this to everybody's attention. So there's this publication that started shortly before Prohibition was repealed in 1933. I found it in the New York Public Library. It's called Brewers News. It was a weekly magazine, and I found an article from 1935 that's called Trademark and Label Protection. Okay, this is 1935. So this isn't new to the industry. Brendan was saying before about the oldest trademark being the triangle. So I think it's really an educational thing. Why are there all of these people getting cease and desist letters or having issues? People don't know. It's not new to the industry. Just because there's growing number of craft breweries and new beers hitting the market. Well, that was true after Prohibition too. So it's, from my perspective, I think probably from Brendan's perspective too, we talked about this, when do you call the lawyer? It doesn't have to be calling a lawyer, but just do your homework. See what else is out there and understand the rights that you have or that you might be infringing upon.
So flip through the article, because it showed it was 1933. It says what, beverage label?
Yeah, I mean, this is under old law, because it's 1935, so the most recent trademark statute's from 1946 and the copyright statute's from 1976, but the concepts are the same. I highlighted something from this 1935 article that I think still applies. The law endeavors to prevent the employment of any medium by which it will be possible for another party to represent his goods as those of another. It seeks to prevent twofold wrong which comes from such sales and wrong suffered by the party whose merchandise is imitated in the sale and the wrong suffered by the customer who did not obtain the known product desired. That's what we were just talking about. The public purchasing the wrong thing. And then trading off of some another brand's goodwill and name.
But, and then there's old labels that were registered, like
sure.
Pacifico. So, tell me some of the labels that jump out. Is Carling in there?
Yeah, there's some really cool ones. There's Utica Club that Brendan and I were just talking about. You want to talk about that? Or?
I think it's just interesting because Saranac, FX Matt Brewing up in Utica, just I think re-released Utica Club in new cans, and I think the logo is exactly the same as it is in that trademark filing from the 19-teens, whenever it was.
Yeah, I just saw this High Life. What else is
so this? This is like right after Prohibition. Everyone was, did they have to re-register brands? Is that what it was? Or register from scratch?
Rheingold, sorry. Amstel.
They may have, yeah.
I think this was for 3-2 beer, which had become legal before other forms of alcohol.
Can I ask you, too? I was like, when he mentioned about writing that awkward letter, I think there's a lot of confusion on the consumer side about these letters. And especially if you look on social media, when anyone, like he just went over it, what, 8 to 10 month process it takes to get this.
I think 18 months.
18 months. Yeah. Oh, there you go. Even more extensive. And someone uses it and it's like, okay, we've gone through this work. And I feel like the consumers, especially online, just see that and go, oh, you know, the big guys are beating up on this, or not even the big guys, from one craft brewer to another. And I think it always is looked at like a really bad thing, and it causes a lot of bad press that might not be warranted. And I just like appreciate that you're talking about how much work goes into getting this and why you need to protect what you have. And am I right that if you don't protect it, you have the risk of losing it? Like if you have an image or...
Sure, it could become a generic term, or you could have abandoned the mark.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what's the... I think Kleenex maybe
Kleenex,
is the famous example.
Xerox,
where Band-Aid.
Band-Aid.
Yeah,
like,
right.
These names were trademarked at one point, but they've become so commonly used that it's just literally a noun now. It's what it's another word for tissue.
Do you guys have any comments on, and not to get controversial in any way, but like the Sierra Nevada Lagunitas back and forth about their IPA. And that wasn't necessarily a word or
so what was,
a beer
it was
name.
The look of
but it was the,
aesthetic,
right? The block letters and things like that, right? So how, and there was a lot of backlash on that on both sides. Where does that come from? How is that protected? What can
The lawyers are thoughtful. They don't want to speak without thinking.
That's nice. That's a good quality. I got to practice that.
Right. I mean, to me, the interesting part about that dispute is how it was quickly resolved by market influences and consumers, right? So if there's a lot of social media backlash, whether it's any brand, really, I actually see this in fashion a lot, too, where there's a lot of politics between the different designers and stuff that, you know, if there's a way to work things out without having to go to court or be in a trademark proceeding, it's more cost efficient, and I think it's usually the best way. But to your question, right, the word IPA is a style of beer, but the artistic rendering of it, if you could consider it a logo in any way,
so
has some level of trademark protection.
Lagunitas is the IPA, whatever that is, font. Do you always think that that's Lagunitas?
Absolutely, yeah.
Sure. Well, if you see a chalkboard at a bar that just says IPA, would you think Lagunitas versus if you saw the stylized
label? Right, exactly.
So then right there, you've just answered the question that there is some sort of brand recognition just by the stylized.
Hey, let's get to, hey, Doug, come back on, bro.
Yep.
Hello? Okay.
Are you listening?
Doug, any reactions, specific reactions you remember or you know, if let's say you do a friendly letter to someone and they write back and they just don't agree, what's the next step?
I have a lot of reactions to everything you're saying, and I'm biting my lip. You know,
don't bite your lip. Go ahead.
The Lagunitas dispute is probably, I think the way it ended up was the best thing probably could ever happen for craft beer, despite the fact that I don't necessarily disagree with Tony's overzealous approach to trying to protect the block letters. I don't agree. I would never take the action he did, I don't blame him necessarily for doing it, and I don't think he should be vilified for it, but the fact that he listened to the court of public opinion and made the decision to back off because it was best for his brand and his consumers and to save face for him as a person, because I'm sure that he has a lot of personal pride as well behind that, was a big step, and I applaud him for doing that. I think that we've seen a lot of other large brewery versus small brewery, which is the difference here, that was large brewery versus large brewery, at least craft brewery. Large brewery versus small brewery, court of public opinion, be very, very swift against the large brewery. It's sad because they're not always correct, but in many instances, larger brand owners are going to be considered a bully regardless of their position and their argument, and that's just the case. Obviously, because the smaller brewers are willing to be more open with it on social media and publicizing it, the larger breweries have PR personnel and public relations marketing teams that are out of house that control the flow of information, and a lot of that stuff keeps private. But these cease and desist letters, you know, the one thing I tell almost every one of my clients is, you don't want me to send a C&D letter. You don't, because it'll probably end up on Beer Pulse.
Right.
Because it always does. And then you'll have tens of thousands of consumers that know about your brand for all the wrong reasons. So we try to be really casual about it. And I say that to, you know, everybody, both clients of mine and friends of mine in the industry, you know, be casual, reach out to the brewers first, talk about it. So many of these can be resolved in a day or less by just having a real business conversation between the business leaders. You know, most business leaders in the space nowadays are educated enough to understand their rights and their posture, and they are I think in the best place to make the decision of what's best for their business. You know, obviously everybody needs to probably consult their legal team and figure out how much they can push, but I would say 90% of the disputes between my clients or my colleagues and other parties are resolved by the internal management team over a casual conversation. And that's, I think, where it needs to start before the C&D letters. Too many larger brewers use larger firms that just kind of punch right with the C&D letter and ends up becoming a PR nightmare for them. And I would just recommend they kind of draw that back a little bit and have a precursor to that. To that level of effort.
Do you think there's a risk of it becoming someone taking advantage, saying, we know you don't want this cease and desist letter out, so too bad? I'm going to put this out anyway.
I think, you know, as I mean, even if it's 24 hours. I mean, well, how long is a wait to take to kind of take the time to do that? I mean, I always, it's strange. I'm a beer lawyer. I represent 100 plus breweries around the country, but I have my own lawyer who I consult with, because I'll be damned if I'm going to make my own legal decisions with my own brand, because I'm too passionate and think I'm too smart to be reasonable sometimes. And even with my own attorney, you know, talking with them, I would always consult them right away, show them the situation, talk it out, plan, come up with a plan of action, and then say, give me 24 hours to see what type of progress I can make. And as long as we're protected, as long as we have everything filed, pending, and we've protected our rights before we speak up, because that's a common mistake, is that some people don't have their stuff filed before they speak up, and then somebody beats them to it. As long as I have, then I think it's the right step, and like I said, 90% of the time, it's going to get it resolved.
And Brendan, want to answer that about filing before you speak up? That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I've definitely come across that a couple of times where more or less you say, and in fact, I can't mention who it is, but I've got that going on, literally that exact situation going on right now with, and the name of the brewery that's at stake. So what happens is you reach out to someone, you know, in a friendly manner to say, hey, you know, we both got similar names, you know, one of us should probably change. And, you know, without having a trademark or at least a application in place before doing that, and that just spurs the recipient of the letter to file a trademark and beat you to the punch.
I agree 100%. I think people, you know, when they get confronted with any sort of aggressive lawyerly letter, can sometimes entrench in their position, and it's harder to come to a resolution. Have that conversation first.
Doug's on the phone, sure. And he's like, he wants to say like another hour's worth. And did you get any tweets, any questions from any beer people that they want answered?
I think we probably answered most of them at this point. Is there any proper way if you just have that nice conversation and you don't agree and it's like, I don't think this is similar, well, I think you're wrong. What can the next step be aside from taking legal action, and is there one?
Probably not. I mean, the only way you can actually get someone to do something is with a lawsuit.
Or there is, if there is a registered mark, I mean, there are proceedings that you can have in the trademark office too, but it's a quasi-judicial proceeding. You are essentially in court.
What about you, Doug?
What about me?
Having a good time?
He's not drinking beers.
He's got 100 beer labels he represents. He's part owner in a brewery. Asheville, North Carolina. Sounds like that's where we're all going to retire, right?
I think so. What was I going to say? You guys... hello? We're losing you, Doug.
I think I lost him with that. But thanks for coming on, man. Last one, quick wrap up. A favorite beer label that, you know, you like, just as a good example of, you know, what a good brand should be.
And one you hate.
Either way, pick one label that you can talk about quickly.
I really like the branding that they're doing at two breweries here in Brooklyn, at Threes and Other Half. Other Half, more modern, like their cans are gorgeous and metallic. And Threes, more clean, classic lines. I really like what both of those guys are doing.
I'm going to go with an old favorite, which is New Glarus Spotted Cow in, outside of Wisconsin, where I went to school. And when I see the label, I just think happiness.
Great. Hey, Doug?
Yeah, I'm here.
Quick, you give us a beer label that you really like, you think that does a great job branding.
Man, I don't know that anybody beats Grimm Artisanal Ales right now. Their packaging is fantastic, really unique. I mean, the goal for any brewery is to create, unique art that is a collage of different types of artistic expression without having it be anchored specifically to any direct shapes or objects that could become disputed down the road. Grimm has awesome, creative, original art. I love their art. Other Half does a really good job with digital design. We did a collaboration with Other Half that came out in the winter that I fell in love with. It was a really cool collaboration between our artist and theirs. And Burial Beer Company, this brewery out of Asheville, they are just absolutely killing it with the art. And you guys should really check them out.
All right, man. Well, thanks for coming on, guys. Brandon, Jordan, Ann, and Doug. And a couple of shout-outs for events. The guys from Bronx Brewery just tweeted me, tomorrow night, June 29th, there's a place in New York City called The Roost, and they got a beer launch there. That's all I know, but check it out. Bronx Brewery's launch tomorrow night. A couple of events that we're behind. It's July Good Beer Month. It's starting next week. Some of you will see that on MailChimp and some social media, and it's a month where the month kind of happens, but we've got some live events at WNYC Green Space in New York City, some specials on Heritage Radio Network, and some other stuff. So check that out and look up cookoutnyc.com. We've got some special events. And anything else, Ann? Anything going on at one of your spots?
I have like a 2 hours worth more of questions about this. This is so much cooler than I kind of expected. No offense.
No, it's good. And you guys, Jordan, and you guys have a site or a Twitter feed that people can follow?
Sure. www.jgreenbergerlaw.com.
Yeah, and my Twitter, I'm just at bpalfrey10.
Bpalfrey10, man. Check it out. All right. So in closing, I'd like to thank our sponsors at Union Beer Distributors who have helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. Thanks to Brendan, Jordan, Doug, and Ann for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Justin Kennedy and Maggie Seiden, and our engineer, David Tadashore. Thanks for listening. See you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo!
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.